Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
We brought you a lot of earnings. The big one we want to focus on, though, of course, is Amazon. Second quarter online stores net sales coming in above estimates. North American net sales for the second quarter coming in above estimates. Physical store net sales coming in above estimates. Second quarter subscription service net sales coming in slightly above estimates. And operating income, that ever important one, coming in way above estimates. The estimates were for $4.72 billion. And we're seeing results of $7.68 billion. Stock up more than 6% in the post-market right now. I want to bring in senior U.S. retail analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence, Poonam Goyal, who has had exactly 7 minutes to go through this entire report. Poonam, give us the big takeaways you have.
Yeah, sure. So just looking at the press release really quickly, it looks good on all fronts. I really can't find anything bad to say today. I think what caught us by surprise and in a good way is really AWS. You know, we were thinking that AWS sales would have slowed given just commentary we had heard from Microsoft, but those came in above expectations and they said the business stabilized. Also, guidance was ahead of consensus. So overall, really across the board, we're seeing pretty good momentum at Amazon.
Well, talk to me about Amazon's retail business as well, because we know that analysts have been looking for signs that those margins are improving after their cost-cutting measures. I know that you're just looking through all of this, Poonam, but what do we know so far about that?
Yeah, I think the cost-cutting is definitely helping, but keep in mind that they continue to invest in that fast and free shipping and really speeding up those timelines. So I think the margin story, more than on the retail side, is just AWS returning to growth and really driving up that profitability to allow for other areas of investment is key here. But we will continue to see them really, you know, remove costs where they're unnecessary or just not driving the ROI that we'd like to see from Amazon.
I was kind of joking, Poonam, a few minutes ago when I talked about, you know, having to take a drink when you saw a mention of AI, just because it's totally what investors want to see. And again, I know you're a retail analyst, senior retail analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence, but we can't talk about Amazon without talking about AWS. And a big portion of Andy Jassy's statement is dedicated to what AWS has been doing when it comes to generative AI in the cloud. What do investors need to know about that?
Yeah, I think AI is going to be in every single conversation we hear from here on for many years to come, whether it's retail or tech companies. And Amazon will continue to invest in AI and will continue to use it as a competitive edge, whether it's for AWS or even for its online business, both on the cost side as well as on the marketing and sales side, where it can really tailor assortments to better meet customers' demand and really drive up that conversion. So we don't see that conversation going away at all. It is going to take center stage. How we're going to determine the actual ROI from each of those initiatives within AI is probably going to be a little harder to really tell.
One of the other things that I'm fascinated in, because I'm such a participant in it, is the Prime Day event. Looks like in the earnings report, more than 375 million items purchased, customers saving more than $2.5 billion. Poonam, I know that the market typically sloughs off Prime Day, but what does the earnings statement tell you about both Prime Day and the future of Amazon as kind of a retailer that consumers are going to go to for these purchases?
Yeah, I think Prime Day is an important event for Amazon. You know, they hold it twice a year, and they already spoke about it once right after the event, where they said that the first Prime Day was actually the biggest online sales day in their history, which means it surpassed Cyber Monday last year as well. So that's encouraging, and it tells us that the consumer is seeking value, and they go to Amazon to find that value. We're in a period of a time where the consumer is really stretched on their dollars. Discretionary spending has been mixed and slowing. As we move into the back half of the year for the all-important holiday season, Amazon needs to continue to stay on top of consumers' mind, show their value promise, and also show that they can have a pretty broad assortment at a good price and can get it to you fast for no cost if you're a Prime member.
Is Amazon where you find value, though? Has it positioned itself as a value leader, especially in relation to and in comparison to Walmart and what Walmart's trying to do with its own Prime competition?
Absolutely. I think, you know, when you think of value, Amazon definitely provides value, especially when you look across Amazon's owned brands, right? I think that's where they can press the pedal a little further. Amazon basic items are provided at a pretty good value to consumers. And then more than value, it's about convenience, right? It's the fact that you go to Amazon and you type in that you want the cell phone charger, and there you go. You have a laundry list of cell phone chargers that you could choose from, some branded, some non-branded, and you can get them same day.
Okay, reminding me about advertising. Advertising revenue. What's Amazon doing? What are we seeing with the most recent quarter when it comes to ad revenue?
Great. It was up 22% in the quarter and continues to be a driving force for Amazon. They're doing really well on the advertising front. We continue to expect to see double-digit gains there. And remember, advertising is that one business that probably could boast the highest profit margins, even better than AWS. So as Amazon scales that business, it's only going to continue to help drive its bottom line.
They also mention in the report the premieres of additional Amazon original films and series, of course, the Emmy-winning Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, on some other great performers for them. Is there anything of note to you when it comes to the Prime Video story in this earnings statement here?
Yes. So, you know, we just ran some data earlier this month, or last month, I should say, in July. The Summer I Turned Pretty was released on July 13th, and that's season two, and we saw a huge uptick in downloads on Prime Video. So content is king for Prime Video. The more better the content that rolls out on Amazon, we think they'll definitely bring up interest in both getting new members onto Prime, as well as just keeping members that are on it still interested and really using the platform more and more in their daily lives.
Poona, before we let you go, talk to us about how to read into the strength of the consumer. You said that the consumer's stretched right now. They're looking for value. Where else can we look in Amazon's report to give us an idea for just how the American consumer, how the American economy is doing?
Yeah, I think the consumer is stretched, but the consumer is making trade-offs. So you're going to see an area of retail where some consumers will choose Amazon and some will choose to move away from some of the other retailers, where they don't really have value, nor are they differentiated, and nor can they provide convenience. So we're going to see a mixed bag of earnings. We just had Revolve report last night, and, you know, they were talking about the consumer being weaker, especially on the luxury end, which is interesting to hear. And then we've heard dollar stores and others talk about how the value consumer is stretched. So it's really about the consumer making trade-offs and going to the retailer that has exactly what they want to meet their needs. And Amazon fits that bucket, is what they just proved.
Bloomberg Intelligence Senior U.S. Retail Analyst Poonam Goyal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Another piece of history being made today as former President Trump is entering the courtroom. He's inside the courtroom for his arraignment on those January 6th charges. This is his third indictment as former president here, again, appearing in a federal courtroom in Washington to be arraigned on those charges that he conspired to remain in office despite the loss of the 2020 election. So we are going to dig into this story right now. We've got Bloomberg Law host and legal analyst June Grasso, and we've also got Bloomberg U.S. legal reporter David Voreakis. I hope I said that correctly, David.
Voreakis.
Thank you so much. Okay. On the latest with the Trump indictment and that arraignment today. David, I want to start with you because we've gotten used to covering this type of event here when it comes to the former president. What is significant about today? What is different for you? What are you watching?
Well, this is what's known as an initial appearance and an arraignment, where Trump will be formally notified of the charges, and he's expected to enter a not guilty plea. The judge will also set bail terms, and it's expected that he would be released until his trial. We don't have a trial date yet. It's possible the judge would set a trial date, but probably not. This is a magistrate judge, and it's the district judge who would probably set the trial date and a schedule for pretrial hearings and motions.
David, I want to stick with you for one more, and then we'll bring in June. But, you know, and Maddie was alluding to this, with President Trump appearing before court, this is the third indictment. And I think there's a risk that people sort of think to themselves, okay, well, this is now normal. This is not normal. This is not normal in U.S. history. Right now, we're seeing a four-count indictment that accuses President Trump of conspiring to defraud the U.S. by interfering with the counting of votes in 2020, obstructing, conspiring to obstruct Congress's certification of the election results, and conspiring against the right to vote. I mean, these are some of these things that were in the indictment go back to the wake of, you know, the Civil Rights Act with voting.
This is an extraordinary moment in our nation's history. The Justice Department has accused him essentially of an assault on democracy. And, you know, Trump and his supporters say that he had a free speech right to say what he said at the time, and that the prosecutors will not be able to show that he had criminal intent here. It's going to be a tremendous legal battle, and it's also going to be extraordinary over the next few months because of the need to set proper schedules between the three trials. And there's also the possibility of a fourth indictment.
This is Georgia, right?
In Georgia, in Atlanta. So we've never seen anything like this in our history. And all of this is bookending Trump's third run for the White House.
I just quickly want to stick with you on the Justice Department because you mentioned that. I'm curious about how much feedback we're going to see the Justice Department getting in terms of the criticism that it's being, that this is political, that this is a political move. How much do you anticipate that commentary coming to the Justice Department?
I expect there's going to be a sustained political attack from the Republican Party, from Trump allies, from conservative media. And I also expect it's likely that the Justice Department won't respond except in court. And so while Trump can make a great deal of comments on social media and live. The Justice Department is greatly constrained in what they can say.
I want to bring in June Grasso. She is the Bloomberg Law host and legal analyst here at Bloomberg. June, every time in the last 48 hours that we've gone by your desk, you've been reading this indictment. I don't know how many times you've read it at this
Three.
Point. Three times. Okay. So it's about 45 pages. Give us your takeaways as you've spent so much time in it and really the gravity of it.
Well, it's hard to overestimate or the gravity of this, and this is an attack on, an alleged attack on American democracy. And what strikes me is the relentlessness with which former President Trump is alleged to have acted in this matter. He was told over and over again, and it's really set out carefully in this indictment. So they talk about how many times he was told and how many people he was told that the elections were fair. And they list, and I think it's important for people to read this. They list, for example, the defendant's vice president, the senior leaders of the Justice Department, Director of National Intelligence, Department of Homeland Security, Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, senior White House attorney, senior staffers on the defendant's reelection campaign, state legislators and officials, state and federal courts. All those people in different ways told President Trump that the election, there was no fraud in the election, and still he went forward and repeated the same things that they had told him were false. For example, he said more than 10,000 voters in Georgia were actually dead. He said that there were 205,000 more votes than voters in Pennsylvania.
These demonstrably untrue.
Yes, and all suitcases of fake votes being counted in Georgia.
Conspiracy theories.
It's if you look at this, if you read it, you'll see how the special counsel has laid out each and every detail, though I'm sure he has not given all the details out in this. And it's overwhelming.
I would also point out there's going to be a legal question of, did Trump really believe these claims that there was fraud in the election? And
how do you prove that, though?
Well, they have a lot of people around Trump who said that he told me this or he told me that. They can use direct statements from his aides. They can also use circumstantial evidence. And it may be that he was repeatedly told that your fraud claims are not true, and he believed it anyway. And so the burden is on the Justice Department and the prosecutors to prove what was in his mind.
Well, and June, I know you know this so well, but on the second page, the indictment acknowledges that former President Trump had that First Amendment right to lie. Talk to me about the distinction that's made in the indictment about the difference between that right and what was done.
So it's surprising to me that Donald Trump's lawyers are still advancing a First Amendment defense, because obviously the special counsel has written this in a way to try to deflect any First Amendment claims. So there's a difference. First Amendment is speech. What they're alleging here is conduct. And there's a big difference in speech and conduct. Because with a conspiracy, with any conspiracy, there are going to be usually words spoken. And that doesn't make it a First Amendment claim. It's the conduct that is at issue here. So the way he's written this is to say, yes, you can say this. Yes, you can even say that the election was false, but that doesn't make it a First Amendment claim. So it's kind of surprising that that seems to be the main thread of the defense here.
What do we know about the co-conspirators mentioned in the indictment too, June? I know there's a lot of speculation about that, but having read it so many times, what can you tell us?
Well, I think we have identified at least five out of the six, and it could be that we've identified the sixth one, but I don't want to say anything at point. But so it's Rudy Giuliani is very obviously conspirator number one. John Eastman's attorney has said that he is conspirator number two. You have Sidney Powell, the lawyer who appeared on so many wild theories, and Jeffrey Clark, who is a former assistant attorney general, and then Kenneth Chesburrow, who is an appellate attorney. Those are the unnamed co-conspirators, and the question is the special counsel going to name them at some point, charge them? Because if he names them, in an indictment, he has to charge them. So.
Well, that's where I want to bring David in, because there's a chance, David, that if you're Rudy Giuliani right now, maybe you're being advised to cooperate with special counsel Jack Smith. And yeah, talk to us about that process there.
It's hard to tell for sure from the indictment whether any of the co-conspirators are cooperating, although there is that possibility. There's one tactical reason that Jack Smith may have only charged Donald Trump, which is if you bring in more defendants, then that could prolong the trial and the proceedings. And it seems, as June suggested, that they want to make this as streamlined as possible to get in the trial before the election.
I just want to say one thing.
Yeah.
I am sure that co-conspirator number two, who is John Eastman, the attorney, is not cooperating because his attorney is said that he's going to send a brief to the special counsel next week setting forth all the reasons why he should not be charged, that
right.
he was acting
June,
as counsel.
We're getting a headline right now that the President Trump expectedly has pleaded not guilty to 2020 election charges. So no big surprise there. But
and he also said that, just to finish it, the thought, mm-hmm. that if he is charged, he will not cooperate. He will not take a plea. So at least he's out of the game.
So, David, I guess it raises the question of one that I wasn't able to answer when a colleague asked me earlier today when I was preparing for this interview with both of you and preparing for him to be at court. Is President Trump going to go to prison? I couldn't answer the question.
First of all, that suggests that he'll be convicted. He has to be convicted. And, it's possible that he could. He faces up to 20 years on the most serious charge.
That's just on one charge.
Right. But the way the federal sentencing works is usually white-collar defendants would serve considerably less time. So I can't answer the question of whether he's going to prison for sure, but I could say that he can run for president under indictment. He can run for president if he's convicted. And even if he goes to prison, he could run for president. There's also the possibility that if he's elected, he could pardon himself. This is something that legal analysts have been talking about, and it's kind of extraordinary and unprecedented.
Right.
But we don't know quite how this will play out, but it seems to be a distinct possibility.
I've talked to lawyers, and they seem to be split on whether or not he would be sent to prison. Hmm. Some lawyers I've spoken to said, well, he could be sent to a country club prison like they have out west, and we've heard about those prisons, right? Or he could be placed under some kind of house arrest arrangement at Mar-a-Lago. Others have said that it might be that the president, who is in office at the time, might do something like think that, okay, he's had enough right now, he's been exposed, and might themselves grant him clemency of some kind. So I don't know if the judge here is a very tough sentencing judge, so I'm not sure she wouldn't send him to prison if convicted.
Well, David, what about Georgia, the potential fourth indictment? Correct me if I'm wrong, but that's one that he couldn't pardon himself from.
Right. The original indictment by the Manhattan DA, Alvin Bragg, and any possible indictment by Fonnie Willis in Atlanta, she's the Fulton County DA, are not subject to pardons or clemencies under the federal system. So it seems that those are charges that present particular peril for Trump, but it also seems that it's almost certain that that the special counsel would like to go first.
Hmm. Well, it's interesting, in June, I know you know this so well, the special counsel is going to focus on the idea that Mr. Trump was not delusional at the time. Is there any chance of that changing because it would save him from prison time?
I don't think so. I think that, in order to prove his case, he's going to have to prove that Donald Trump had intent, as David was saying. And, that's true of any crime, that you have to prove intent. And I think that there's no way that the special counsel would deviate from that or in any way say that Donald Trump was not of sound mind in this. The defense may try that, but no, seriously,
right.
I just don't think that, some of the defenses that they've put out are what you said, First Amendment, advice of counsel. There are different ways that they'll approach it. They also have sort of, as Donald Trump has said over and over and over again from years and years, that it's a witch hunt and that he's being prosecuted, that there's a, favoritism in the prosecution. So that may be another one, but he is of sound mind.
And then timeline, I feel like, is the next big important question, because we do want to know whether or not there's a chance that he could be back in the Oval Office by the time that this case is decided. What do we know about the timeline?
Well, I'll give you a live update. Trump has pleaded not guilty in federal court in D.C. The judge is releasing him without bail, and he's agreeing to various conditions of release. But there is no trial set yet in this case. Manhattan DA's case is scheduled for March, and the Mar-a-Lago documents case is scheduled for May.
The New York Attorney General's suit is also is going in October, and then Jean Carroll in January.
Sorry, guys. We're going to wrap because we got to break the Apple earnings, but June, we're going to have you back in a bit.
I do want to thank both of you. That's June Grasso. She is Bloomberg Law host and legal analyst, and also, of course, Bloomberg U.S. legal reporter David Voriakis on the latest with the Trump indictment.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
All right, well, plenty of news to get to. Fortunately, we go from Amazon earnings to the latest with President Trump's indictment to Apple earnings, and we've got great guests for all of them, including our next one, Thomas Thornton, president and founder of hedge fund Telemetry, on the latest Apple earnings, joining us. You have, Tom, had only, you know, wow, look at this, 3 minutes to go through these numbers, but give us your gut reaction here.
You know what? It looks like it's pretty much in line. I think everybody was expecting services to offset the weaker hardware, and that's generally what we got. Mac was a little better, iPad a little lighter. EPS was better, and revenues were sort of in line. I think I'm a buy-sider, so I think that the buy side had a little higher expectation for revenues. But, you know, I think it's pretty much in line, and now we want to see what we're going to get for the next quarter.
How do you think they did that with EPS? How did they get EPS to come in above estimates when revenue was just in line? What did they do on the inside there last quarter?
You know, they could. I think I noticed some of their operating expenses were lower. Mm. And, you know, they've got the massive buyback, and that guy that does the buyback should be getting the biggest bonus.
That's a good point.
With his elbow on the buy button all day.
That's a good point.
That was such a great question, Tim, of how they got there. That I love that question. I'm stealing that for the rest of earnings for the rest of my life covering them. Tom, I want to go to you on the iPhone revenue missing estimates. I know that we kind of anticipated that, particularly because of the sluggish sales of the iPhone and some of those other devices there. But talk to me about how critical it's going to be moving forward for Apple to really dig deep into those iPhone sales, figuring out ways to get consumers to either upgrade or get new products.
Well, I'm a little surprised that the iPhone sales were light. They were expected to be up 1% year over year, which isn't so great, but it's light. And now they have the iPhone 15 that it's coming out. I don't think it's necessarily going to be a big event from a new feature standpoint. It's going to look pretty much the same, a little better camera. And, you know, the one reason I thought that they would have a little bit better iPhone sales was they cleared out a lot of inventory in June and in China, especially. So it's it'll be interesting to see what the management says on the call regarding that.
I'm really glad you brought up China, because I want to talk about the Greater China story. Third quarter Greater China revenue was a bright spot for the company, $15.76 billion. Estimates were for $14.59 billion. Dig deeper there, though. The China story is so important to Apple, and it's got a very complicated relationship with the country when it comes to how it stores its data, where its products are made, and increasingly where its products are not going to be made in the future as it transitions at least some of them to suppliers and to manufacturers who are building plants in India. Talk to us about the China story.
Well, first of all, Tim Cook is the best CEO because he knows how to play the political game very, very well. He does it all the time in China, and he does it in the U.S. as well. But I think that the one thing about China that I'm a little concerned about going forward is they just announced that they're going to put limitations on children and their handsets, their phones. So that could be a little bit of a problem going forward because they did see a pickup in services. And services
That's interesting.
Picked up because there were a lot of games released in the second quarter in China, and that China approved them. So this could be a little bit of a headwind going forward.
So let me get this straight. If a kid is not staying up late after 10 p.m. in their room playing on their iPad or their iPhone games and not buying those games or not buying products within the games if they're in-app purchases in China because China's cracking down on that, you see that as a real headwind for the company?
It's a risk. I think that they had a lot of momentum coming out of Q2, and it could be a little bit of a headwind for them. I think kids are going to try and figure out a way to, you know, download games and play games as much as they possibly can. More now.
I don't know. Yeah, but I don't know how that looks in China. How do you control for that? I truly don't know.
Well, you know, China can do a lot of different things with Apple and to shut down some of the access that people can have to their phones.
For context, Maddie, I just want to repeat sort of how important of a segment Greater China is as a reportable segment. In the most recent quarter, the 3 months that ended July 1st, 2023, it was the third biggest reportable net sales by reportable segment, coming after Europe with $20 billion in the Americas with $35.3 billion. Greater China coming in, Maddie, at $15.758 billion.
Yeah, and it's just interesting. I mean, looking at the headline here, it kind of says it all. From Mark Gurman, Apple meeting estimates after services help offset that hardware slump. I wonder how the China story plays into that from your perspective, Tom. Is there a world in which that hardware slump is saved because of the China story for Apple?
Well, there were a couple sell-side notes that I read that said that you know, we had a big iPhone sell-through in June. It was a big month. A lot of inventory cleared, but they saw some China deceleration in July. So those are the early checks that we're seeing right now. So it's going to be tough too with the new phone. I just can't really get too excited about it. There's been some talk about delays.
Yeah.
There's also that going around.
Okay, so Tom, you give me the opportunity to kind of like, you know, you read my mind here. I was thinking as we went into this report today, I used to cover this company so closely. I used to get every new iPhone as a review model. I don't even know which iPhone I have anymore. It takes great pictures. It runs fast. It does everything I need it to do. And I don't see myself upgrading at the same rate that I used to upgrade. This is a story I've been saying for 5 years at this point.
Yeah, that's true. You can go back and look at the past three iPhones, and you've heard the bulls say, we're going to see this giant refresh upgrade cycle that's going to happen. I think this one's going to be a little tougher, too, because they are planning on raising the prices of the phones. And one thing that's probably smart for them is they're going to focus on the high priced phone to push out a little harder out there into the market. But look, if the economy slows, if you have the college student loan repayments start to happen, I think that's going to be a little bit tough. And the other thing is people are sort of throwing away this next quarter, and they're looking more towards the December quarter. So I think that's why the stocks moved higher in anticipation for the wide release of the iPhone 15. So I think that's kind of what's happening. The market isn't really punishing the stock too much right now. It looks like it's pretty much in line.
Wait, pause for me on the student loan story. You're saying that the unpausing of student loan repayments in the fall is potentially a sizable headwind for Apple sales?
Yeah, absolutely. If the average repayment is $400 a month, I think that's going to change a lot of consumers' spending plans. And certainly, again, as Tim said, if your phone is working just fine, why do you really need to upgrade to a phone that is basically the same as what you have right now? There's nothing really that exciting in the next phone that's going to have lines around the block and people waiting for the next great thing.
Well, I think that's exactly why you saw the release of Apple's Vision Pro, the unveiling. I don't want to say the release. That's why we saw the unveiling in the last few months of Apple Vision Pro, Tom, because that is where Apple sees a growth area. It's just so different than anything Apple has ever released in the past, not just because of price, not just because of product category, but because of availability and how they're not making it available to so many people. What's your read on it?
I think that Apple is flexing its muscles as far as a technology company again, and that's really nice to see. We've all been enamored with all the great technology that Apple's released over the years, and this is certainly something that is really, really stunning. The technology is just mind-blowing. I haven't seen one. Obviously, nobody's really seen it, but I just think the price point's going to be difficult, and they're not going to have this in wide release until the first quarter next year. So this is really something that they're going to, I mean, it's kind of a bad thing that they're going to miss the holiday seasonal shopping for this new product.
Oh, that's funny. I would really not want that under my Christmas tree, but I can imagine a lot of people would, so I understand it. I'm sorry. Rude. I'm really headsets. Like, I can't. I'm not the market for it, and I also feel like women don't want to wear headsets, but that's a separate story that we're going to cover. I also want to talk to you about the earnings call, because I anticipate that there are going to be a lot of questions about the headset, a lot of other questions about iPhone sales, how they're planning to deal with that. What would your single biggest question be?
Well, there's three things that I think they're going to talk about. And let's just start right with the obvious, AI. What are they going to say about AI? And then there's India, then the headset. They'll talk about that. And then obviously they'll talk about the iPhone 15 and how wonderful it's going to be. But AI is what people are going to be listening for. If they have something that's meaningful that they're going to release for the consumer, maybe this quarter or next quarter.
What would that look like?
It's probably going to be something like Siri, something in a very advanced type of search product that they'll have. I don't know. I just think it'll be interesting to see if they can come up with something that's different and unique and something that people can use on their phones seamlessly, like every other Apple product.
Tom, we really appreciate you taking the time and joining us this afternoon, especially only having 3 minutes to actually go through these numbers. You gave us a lot of really good stuff. That's Thomas Thornton, president and founder of the hedge fund Telemetry, joining us to talk about the latest Apple earnings.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline, it's teamwork, and it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Business Week,
Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
We're going to go back to D.C. here because former President Trump is expected to leave the courthouse soon. The hearing has wrapped up, and we're getting some reports in about potential next steps when it comes to trial dates. So we're going to jump right into it with our guests here. We've got Bloomberg Law host and legal analyst June Grasso. We've also got a fantastic guest to talk about this, Robert Mintz. He is a former federal prosecutor and partner at McCarter and English to talk with us about this as well. June, I'm
a household name to you, June. I feel like you guys know each other.
Yes, he is.
Okay.
I've known him for decades, years and years and years.
As soon as Maddie said, introduced you, Robert, she said, Bobby.
I mean, you two should just talk. Like, just go. Tim and I don't need to be here.
Go ahead, Maddie. I jumped on you there.
No, June, jump in.
Yeah. No, what I wanted to say and get Bob's opinion on this. So the magistrate judge who told Trump that she's consulted with the trial judge has set August 28th as the next hearing date in Judge Chutkan's court, and also in 7 days wants briefings about how long the case is going to take. So does that indicate to you that they're going to try to move this quickly?
I think they will try to move it quickly. I think the judge here wants to get her hands around the issues in this case as soon as possible. She wants to put the defense on the record as to what they think they're going to need in terms of timing to be ready to go to trial. I'm sure the prosecution is going to say they'll be ready to go as quickly as possible, as quickly as they can get a trial date from the judge. So it's really going to be up to the defense to try to explain what time they need. They're going to want discovery, obviously, from the prosecution. The extent of that discovery is going to drive the timing of this trial, how many documents. What kind of discovery are we talking about? You know, unlike the Mar-a-Lago case, where there were all kinds of issues about national security because of the nature of that case, we really don't have that here so much, if we have it at all. And so this case could be fairly streamlined. And I do think that this judge is going to try to move this case along as quickly as she can.
Well, as you mentioned, though, Trump's lawyers will do whatever they can to delay it. Robert, as a former federal prosecutor here, what do you anticipate that they could do that would be effective in their efforts to delay the trial?
Well, I think they're going to tell the judge they need a certain amount of time to absorb all the information. Again, I think it will depend on the volume of discovery that prosecutors are going to provide to them. We just don't really know what that is at this point, but there could be literally hundreds of interviews. Those may or may not be memorialized in grand jury testimony, for example. They could be memorialized in what's called a 302, which is an FBI memorandum that memorializes the interview. All that stuff has to be provided to the defense, and the defense does have to have a reasonable amount of time to absorb that information, to prepare for trial. And the judge will be sensitive to that. I mean, she's going to want to move this case along, but she also is going to be very aware that the defense does have to have a reasonable amount of time to get ready here, because if she moves too quickly, that creates some kind of an issue. Even if there's a trial, even if there's a conviction, it could be overturned on appeal if the defense can say, we were just simply not ready to defend this case. So we're going to have to see what the discovery looks like. That will ultimately drive the scheduling here.
Excuse me, I got to turn my microphone on. If you're watching us on YouTube, you can see on the right side of the screen, President Trump has left court after pleading not guilty. He's now making his way to Reagan National Airport to board his jet. June, I want to know about timing here. And we did just hear from Robert about, you know, the delicate balance that the judge has to sort of walk to make certain that the defense has enough time to prepare, but also that it's not something that's delayed. Well, especially there are political implications here, too.
Absolutely. He's going to be campaigning. And, you know, one of the dates that they set was that they were considering was near one of the debates, which he said he hasn't going to be in. And a lot of these hearings, the defendant doesn't have to be there for the hearings themselves. But I think what's really interesting, and I mentioned this before, is that D.A. Alvin Bragg, who has a firm trial date of March 25th of next year, has said that in the interest of justice, he would consider, you know, moving that trial date. And let's all face it, this case is considered the most important of the cases because of what allegedly happened here. And so I would think that this is the case, and it'd be interesting to see whether the prosecution is going to try to move this case faster than the classified documents case, which, as Bob and I have discussed just recently, the classified documents case seems like it's more straightforward, but you have all those classified documents that have to be dealt with. And another thing is, John Laura, who is one of Trump's attorneys, was on, I think it was CNN the other night, and he was saying that this trial could take 9 months or a year. Bob, obviously, that seems a little bit long.
Well, you know, it is and it isn't. I mean, I've tried lots of cases in federal court and defended them, and it's not that unusual to have a trial that ultimately goes to trial, you know, a year or more after the indictment. But again, that depends on a lot of other factors, you know, like the volume of documents that the defense has to review and analyze, you know, whether they need to engage experts, for example, in a financial fraud case. The defense is going to say, you know, judge, we need to hire an accountant, a forensic accountant, to go through all this. Then you've got issues about scheduling with the lawyers, other schedules, and of course you have the judge's schedule. But this is a case that is so important that clearly the judge is going to clear her schedule to try this as soon as possible, and I think she's going to expect the same from the defense lawyer. She's not going to say, well, we're going to bump this trial because the defense lawyer has got a conflict with some other trial. You know, this case,
Laura was saying that the case, the trial itself could take 9 months to a year, you know, the trial.
Right.
Not getting to trial. Well, I mean, do you think that's an overestimate?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is, because, you know, the length of the trial is going to be largely driven by the prosecution, right? I mean, in any case, what typically happens is, you know, most of the witnesses, and many times all of the witnesses, are prosecution witnesses. The defense usually does not put on many witnesses at all. Now, that's not to say that in this case they may not call some witnesses, but the government bears the burden of proof. Obviously, the government has to prove each and every element of the case beyond a reasonable doubt. And so the burden is on them to put the case on. It's their case. They can streamline this case as much as they see is necessary in order to move it along. I see no way this case would last a year to try. That's just hyperbole. That's never going to happen.
Robert, I want to jump in because we don't have a ton of time. And given that you're a former federal prosecutor, you're now a partner at McCarter and English as well. How strong is the government's case?
Well, I think it's a pretty strong case, but I do think there are some defenses here, and, you know, the defense here has already alluded to that. You know, this is a case that's going to be tried in the court of public opinion long before it ever gets to the courtroom. That's clearly the defense strategy here. You know, they're looking for some type of jury nullification, which means they have to convince just one juror to not vote to convict, regardless of what the evidence is, if they believe that the entire process has been rigged. I think that's what they're shooting for here. But they are going to raise the First Amendment issue, that this is really a free speech case. And they're also going to raise this advice on lawyers. They're going to say that President Trump relied on the advice of these counsel, and as such, he's allowed to rely on that, and that's a defense. If those lawyers were wrong, it's not his fault. He hasn't committed a crime.
Well, I also want to ask about the point that you made earlier, June, about the timelines of the different cases here.
Yeah.
Bob, I'm curious, from your perspective, what's the right strategy for that?
Well, first of all, you know, they can't really control Alvin Bragg, as June said, but he's already agreed to step back, which makes a lot of sense. So we really have these two federal cases at this point, unless the DA in Atlanta also jumps into the fray here. I think if I'm the special counsel, I'm looking at that case at Mar-a-Lago. I do think there's strong facts, but it's not as compelling a case. And the defense, frankly, does have a better argument, given the classified documents, that this case is going to take a long time. So I think we're going to see the government double down on this case and try to push this forward as quickly as they can.
Especially because in Florida, they had a superseding indictment adding another defendant, which makes it a little more complicated. They have now three co-defendants. So that's another reason why that case may lag.
Robert, if you are special counsel Jack Smith right now, how confident are you feeling about this?
I think he's pretty confident. I think there's obviously a lot of evidence out there. His indictment was incredibly detailed. It showed a lot of work that the special counsel's office had done. They've done a lot of interviews. They've got statements, obviously, from, you know, Vice President Pence, you know, former U.S. Attorney General Bill Barr. I mean, there's all kinds of people there who obviously were giving advice to former President Trump that the election was not stolen, that he didn't win the election, and he went on to make these statements anyway. They also have his statements. And I also think the prosecutors are holding back some of that evidence. They're not going to show their entire hand in this indictment. So I think there's more to come when this case actually goes to trial.
Yeah, Mark Meadows, just mentioned as chief of staff in passing a couple of times. Now, you got to wonder, if he's not a co-conspirator, is he cooperating?
Does he seem... Yeah, you're not going to... You already went through the co-conspirators, June.
He's not one of the co-conspirators that are unnamed.
Oh, so you're saying...
But I'm speculating that since he's not, and he was so involved in what Trump was doing, I mean, he was on the phone call with the Georgia Secretary of State, remember that? And I'm speculating, is he then cooperating, and that's why he's not listed?
That's a great point.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there, guys. Really appreciate both of you joining us this afternoon. A special thanks to our guests, Bloomberg Law host and legal analyst June Grosso, and also Robert Mintz, former federal prosecutor and partner at the law firm McCarter & English, joining us to talk the latest with President Trump.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's going to drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
You drive, stay in prison.
It's the question that drives us.
You drive me crazy.
This is The Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, well, we got fewer than 17 minutes on the way to close right now. And despite some of the selling yesterday, we're seeing a bit of stability in the broader markets as we wait to hear results from Apple and Amazon. Taking a look at what's going on the S&P 500, we're down 0.2%, the Dow down 0.1%, the NASDAQ down 0.1%. Here to discuss the big picture as well as today's trade is Beata Kerr, Chief Impact Officer at the Copia Group. It's a private equity firm. Beata was, though, formerly co-head of investment and wealth strategies at Bernstein Private Wealth Management. So we know that even though she's at a PE firm now, she does not ignore the public markets. Beata, good to have you with us this afternoon. First of all, what's a chief impact officer do?
Well, thanks for the question and thanks for having me. You're right, public markets and private markets are very correlated, and impact is very correlated to investment. In the Copia Group, we are focused on providing capital to lower middle market companies, in particular diverse owned businesses. And as an impact officer, I'm focused on measuring the impact of our capital, which ultimately we think will help narrow the wealth gap for underrepresented communities in the U.S.
When you say providing capital, do you mean you're investing in these companies as a private equity partner, as a venture capital partner, or using private credit?
Well, it is the latter. It is private credit. And that is where we are squarely focused as a capital provider. And one of the great benefits of private credit is that it's non-dilutive capital. And we know equity in businesses is in fact the greatest asset to forming wealth in this country. So providing capital for growth that is not dilutive, gets the owner to retain their equity, yet accelerate growth, is really the vehicle of investment that we've chosen.
So why does a company come to you instead of a bank for money?
Well, first of all, the banks used to be 70% of the capital provider for lower middle market companies. At last count, post-Silicon Valley, it is 10%. So we know post-GFC, there was a huge retrenchment of banks from a regulatory perspective, and this year's events have only continued that trend. So frankly, the banks have been there for them for shorter-term financing, accounts receivable, revolvers, but growth capital, acquisition capital with an average tenor of 4 to 5 years, private credit, organizations have really stepped up to be the primary providers for this really important segment of our economy.
Can I ask you about private credit? Because I'm curious about what happens to our economy when private credit stops being able to kind of save us. Am I right to be worried about that?
I think it's a great question. I think it's always great to worry about the next thing. I think what's interesting about private credit, it's actually been around for over 30 years. It's just been part of banking institutions. And I think the leading private credit lenders in today's market in many ways have been former bankers, if you will. So private credit capital has been around just in various functions and different types of organizations. And I think the other thing that's reassuring is that Lately, there is no evidence of private credit going away. In fact, it's really an exploding asset class from the positive sense in terms of many capital providers, such as ourselves, launching to really be there for those organizations.
Yeah, and you mentioned kind of always wanting to look ahead to the next shoe to drop and the next negative thing that could be coming. It makes me think about the jobs report that we're going to be getting in tomorrow, likely to be positive as it has been. But what are you anticipating, and what are you thinking that the market reaction could look like tomorrow?
Well, at the Copia Group, I'm going to center my answer more around how that affects the lower middle market businesses that we're in particular focused on. And one of the key statistics I'll share is that, in fact, lower middle market businesses are the fastest growing segment of the middle market. And in fact, they've been hiring aggressively. So statistics show that these businesses continue to be revenue positive. And while wages are going up and they're managing margins, and that's an area of pressure, job growth is actually something that we see as a positive trend in the private markets. And as you know, in the broader public and private market picture, this economy has appeared to be very resilient. So I thought the Fitch downgrading this week was interesting timing, because obviously jobs and wages have remained quite robust and the U.S. economy has not appeared to be struggling. So I would just add that broader perspective on recent macro events.
Economists surveyed by Bloomberg are expecting the payrolls report to show, wow, look at that, 200,000 tomorrow. And last month's would be 209,000. By last month, I mean June, because we're doing July tomorrow. So beyond payrolls tomorrow, let's talk broader about the equity markets. And again, I know you're in private equity now, you're focused on private credit, but you do not ignore what's going on in the equity markets. We're up on the S&P 500 more than 15% so far this year, more than 17%, even with the pullback that we've seen this week. Are we in over our skis?
Well, I'm not sure we're in over our skis. We might be at the beginning of a new bull market, frankly. There's a lot of robust nature to the economy. I think we should just watch valuations relative to earnings. As you know, earnings and multiples do tell the story of the equity markets. And I think you could see some pullback given how robust this rally has been. But another thing to point out about the rally is remember how narrow it has been. It's reminiscent of prior equity rallies where you had a couple of key names, note in the technology space, really driving most of the return. So I think kind of bringing it back to private credit, I think what we're seeing is a lot of enthusiasm from allocators that might be long-term optimistic about equities, but feel really great about investing with companies with our cash flowing businesses and yield in the meantime, while there might be some ongoing volatility in the equity markets.
How much do you think about big earnings like Apple and Amazon today in your kind of overview on your work?
Not that much. You know, what affects our earnings and what happens to our companies is ultimately Fortune 500 growth does affect the types of companies we're looking at, because we're looking at investing in healthcare and business services and logistics, in distribution and in food. So of course the supply chain is gonna flow through to lower middle market businesses. And in particular, what we would note is commitments to invest with diverse suppliers is a net benefit to the opportunity set that we see here at the Copia Group.
Right.
So of course the overall economy matters. Day by day earnings, especially I'd say for the tech companies, a little bit less of an area of focus for the sectors that we're keying in on.
Beata, just 10 seconds. What's your recession outlook for the next 12 months?
I think we're in a soft landing scenario. I think I'm optimistic and constructive about the overall economy.
All right, there it is. Have to end on some Soul Asylum. Sarah, great choice. Nice job.
We love the music.
We do love the music here. Beata Kerr, Chief Impact Officer at the Copia Group. We really thank you for taking the time today.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kruszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, let's face it, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. There's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.